It was a great location to be in terms of being in city centre Dublin. During that time, I took a lot of advantage of being connected with the National Concert Hall. And I don't know if you remember that, but, you know, as students, we used to be allowed to go into some of the rehearsals for, like, some of the really major acts that were there, like the Berlin Philharmonic or Yehudi Menuhin or all these other fabulous international musicians.
I'm Professor Pat Murray, and it's great to be back hosting the UCD School of Medicine podcast series, MGA Clinical Influencers, now in its sixth season. The MGA plays a vital role in keeping our School of Medicine graduates in touch with fellow alumni across Ireland and around the world. I'm a UCD School of Medicine alumnus from 1988. I was Dean and Head of the School of Medicine at UCD from December 2012 to June 2018. I'm a Professor of Clinical Pharmacology at UCD and a Consultant Physician at the Mater Misericordiae University Hospital in Dublin, as well as Clinical Lead of the UCD Clinical Research Centre. Dr. Elaine Lockhart graduated from UCD Medicine in 1988. She completed her psychiatric training in the west of Scotland, going on to spend more than two decades as a consultant in paediatric liaison psychiatry at the Royal Hospital for Children in Glasgow. Dr. Lockhart is a consultant with the Edinburgh practice and was vice chair and then chair of the Royal College of Psychiatrists in Scotland's child and adolescent faculty, followed by the chair of the UK Royal College of Psychiatry child and adolescent faculty. She worked as a clinical advisor for CAMHS within the Scottish Government from 2018 to 2021. She's been active in teaching, training and research and is an honorary senior lecturer at the University of Glasgow. Dr. Lockhart was awarded the Royal College of Psychiatrists President's Medal 2025 and the Royal College of Psychiatrists Child and Adolescent Team of the Year in 2017. Hello, Elaine, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the invitation.
And as we were just chatting, it's a little different than the usual case of interviewing a classmate. So hopefully I won't give away too many secrets.
Indeed. And I'll try not to give away too many about yourself, Pat. But it's a pleasure to see you. And lovely to be part of the UCD podcast.
Very good. Well, we're going to start off very easy for you. I don't know the answer to this question, but you can tell us maybe how you decided to study medicine and how you ended up doing it in UCD.
I have a distinct lack of imagination, I think, because both my parents were doctors. And for a while at school, I was very clear that I certainly wasn't going to do medicine. And I was exploring other options from being a vet to a ballet dancer to a barrister. But actually, when it came to looking at the subjects I was good at and what I was enjoyed, the one that really captured me in fifth and sixth year was biology. And I think it was just getting into the detail of the human body. And I just found that intriguing. And also thinking about that idea of working, you know, in a career where you would hopefully be of help to other people, but also, you know, it carries with it a lot of advantages and privileges, including the ability to work in a huge range of settings and to be able to travel with it. So, yes, I was very lucky to get into UCD. To study medicine. And once I was there, it felt like the right place for me.
Well, I can't let you go with the ballet dancing as an aside. What became of that?
I guess I should have taken up lessons to start with. No, it was just, you know, thinking about all sorts of things. And probably the more realistic one was thinking about being a vet, because I was completely hooked on James Herriot and all those stories. But coming from County Galway, where, you know, vets that were used by mostly farmers and owners of very large animals, and realizing that maybe with my petite frame, I wasn't best set up to do that kind of work. Working with humans, I think, was probably a better option.
Yeah, I think they've a lot of tools to make up for those problems now. I think it's no longer a barrier.
I think that's right. And there's a huge urban veterinary practice. But I'm very happy. And I think sometimes, you know, things fall in a certain way if you're lucky enough. And it felt like things lined up well for me.
So then you arrived to Belfield for your pre-med year. What kind of things did you get up to that year?
Well, I was one of about half of the class who weren't living at home in their family homes in Dublin. And it felt like a huge leap forward to leave school and to be able to live in Dublin and go to Belfield, where it obviously was a busy campus, nothing like it is now. But I think the first year was very much about adjusting to the change and about working things out socially as well as academically. And it felt like it was a great year in terms of just getting to know classmates and other people. Like, we shared the lectures with the vet students, and we were on the same campus as lots of other schools. So it was just a great chance to be liberated from, I have to say, I was at a convent boarding school, so it was quite a change to be up in Dublin. And I think it was just that combination of being able to come and go much more freely, although our timetable was pretty packed. And then also that realization that having done fairly well at school, suddenly I was surrounded by people who were clearly much brighter than I was, and having to think about making sure I passed exams as I went along. Belfield itself, the pre-med courses didn't particularly grab me, I have to say. It was fine. Some of it was repetition of what we'd done in school. I finally had to confront physics, which I'd never been a big fan of. So, yeah, I don't think I was completely captivated by the content of that, but I was very happy to be there when we were there. And I remember a few concerts at the Students' Union, which were good fun. And otherwise, it was just being able to go to each other's houses and parties that seemed to involve most of the year was very, very enjoyable.
And did you join many societies or any of that kind of thing?
No, I don't think so. I think I got a bit distracted during Freshers' Week. So I do remember the Ag Society offered everyone a free potato if you joined. So that was clearly an advantage. But actually, mostly I think I was just catching up and getting to know people in the year and going along to occasional different clubs with other people. And, you know, even thinking now about, you know, all the kind of physical activities and facilities we had, I tried out various things. But just by the fact we were cycling and moving around the city quite a lot, that was kind of my main exercise at the time. And otherwise, I think I was just more into the kind of music and socialising aspect.
Very good. And then moving into the terrace, was that was a plus for you, was it?
I think we were really lucky to be in Arthur Terrace. It was a great location to be in terms of being in city centre Dublin. And also during that time, I took a lot of advantage of being connected with the National Concert Hall. And I don't know if you remember that, but, you know, as students, we used to be allowed to go into some of the rehearsals for, like, some of the really major acts that were there, like the Berlin Philharmonic or Yehudi Menuhin or all these other fabulous international musicians, and getting student rates for things. But also just being able to cross over to Stephen's Green and into Grafton Street felt really, really special place to be. So, yeah, I have to say I didn't feel any major pang leaving Belfield. I think being in Arthur Terrace was just terrific. And I don't know if you remember, I think we didn't use the gardens much except for that time that the uni was closed for snow days. And I do remember a couple of good snowball fights out in the garden there.
Yeah, well, I certainly remember the crossing to Grafton Street and the garden, but I have to admit, I didn't take advantage of the National Concert Hall at all. I'd say you were more cultured even back then.
Well, I think I was lucky because music was a big part of my school. So even without having any particular talent, I was interested. And there was a few of us in the year who would go together. So I think, again, sometimes it's about meeting up with like-minded people and finding your way with them.
And in terms of the subjects in Arthur Terrace, did you have a favourite or a favourite teacher?
Well, I guess I was thinking about that and how what was most memorable was, like for lots of people, I think, was that focus on anatomy in First Med and Professor Coakley, and about how that was a big step up, that idea that we were spending hours in lectures and seminars and encountering cadavers and dissection. That was a kind of moving into the what felt like much more preclinical topics. So that was the one that probably left the most impression. And then the variety of subjects after that, I mean, I remember pathology and microbiology and pharmacology and all of that. But for me, the preclinical subjects were something that needed to be done and gotten through. And my focus was always to make sure I had a summer holiday. So, you know, that would galvanize me into doing a bit of studying. But I think I came much more into myself when we started doing the clinical work. And I think for a couple of years, we just used to go for half day a week, isn't that right, into our hospitals before we really got into our clinical attachments.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously the big branch point is deciding whether you're going to the matter of instance, right? How did you make that decision?
Oh, I think I was probably easily led, Pat. So I just went along with some friends and we went to the matter, and it felt like a really good move. It was the other side of the city, so I guess that was no harm to have to get on our bikes and to travel over. But yeah, the matter felt like a good place to be, both in terms of what it was offering, but also with the cohort of us who moved there.
And then, of course, paediatrics was, were you Temple Street or Crumlin? Or?
I was in Temple Street and I just was in Crumlin, I think, for occasional visits or and for my paediatric final exam.
In terms of obstetrics, did you go to Coombe or Hollis Street?
I went to Hollis Street, which was very much around the corner from where I was living. So that was very handy. And again, you know, it is interesting what stays with you. So it felt like, you know, I think we were very lucky with the quality of the teaching and what we were learning and getting the experience from our lecturers and the professors of the time. But it was the reality actually of going around the wards and seeing some of the mothers, and particularly one very early on in Hollis Street, where she was a teenage mother and she had given birth to a child with Down syndrome. They were just in a complete state of shock, because as you'll know, I mean, that's just not what you'd expect from a young mum. And it was just learning a little bit of the kind of care that went in after the baby had arrived. The baby had arrived safely, but this family were needing a lot of support with the fact that they had a child who was going to need additional support.
Were you already interested in mental health at that stage?
Well, I had a very interesting attachment, Professor Ivor Brown's team for psychiatry, which I think is very much different to what might be offered in most psychiatry placements. And so, yeah, we had a fascinating few weeks there. And I think once or twice we might have gone into a psychiatric hospital up to St. Brendan's, but generally it was very much about his particular take on psychiatry and psychotherapeutic methods. So I was intrigued. I didn't see it as my career, but it was a fascinating 5 weeks.
So that wasn't where it started for you, interest in psychiatry?
No, where it started for me was, I mean, as I say, I found it intriguing. But after I was working within paediatrics, I really enjoyed working with children and families. But I was always fascinated by the children who kept coming back, not for any clear reasons. Sometimes they would just be presented again and again. And I was always wondering what was going on with them, as well as those children who had kind of chronic and life-limiting conditions. And during the lectures for the DCH, there was a lecture there by a child psychiatrist, and I remember something clicking into place and thinking, wow, that's what I want to do. And I think it was that combination of thinking not just about the physical well-being of the child immediately in front of you, but thinking about the wider kind of family context in which the child was living, but also thinking about their emotional and mental health and well-being.
And is it difficult to bridge the paediatric part if you're focused on being a psychiatrist? Is it hard to put the two together?
Well, I would hope, I suppose part, I think most of my career has been about bringing those two things together, actually. Most of my career was working in the Children's Hospital in Glasgow as a consultant in paediatric liaison psychiatry. I think I was lucky that, you know, when we graduated, we were really able to choose what we wanted to do in terms of moving around and not having to go straight into any program of training. As you know, I'm based in the UK and have been now for a few decades, where it's very much a streamlined process. So I kind of wasn't quite sure what I was going to do after I graduated and thought, well, I may as well go and do a few different things. And that included paediatrics and A&E and a bit of GP locuming, etc. So having the interest in the kind of broader picture, but also having a good grounding in physical medicine, I think has been really stood me in good stead.
That makes sense. What do you remember about the graduation day?
The graduation day was a very lovely sunny day, and it was a real day of celebration. And it was lovely because not only were we all getting together to enjoy the fact that we'd made it. But our parents were there who had been supporting us and looking after us and getting through this over the years. For them, they knew quite a few of my friends and they also knew other people's parents. And it was just a very joyful, lovely day. And I'd been away with some friends for 2 weeks where we had just collapsed in a heap. So we came back looking a bit more rested and fresh after that.
After your couple of years in the matter then, did you decide to stay for your internship?
I did, yes. And again, that felt like a really great move forward. You know, 6 years of university felt like enough. I don't know if other people have the same experience. I found it very difficult being a medical student on the wards in some ways, although it was very interesting. It was hard not to feel you were in the way. And sometimes you were imposing yourself on people who were clearly unwell, which is why they were in hospital. And the idea was you would go and get experience by talking to them or examining them or practicing on them. And that was quite tricky. And I guess we were often moving around in groups where we always seemed to be in other people's ways on the wards or in theatres or whatever. So being an intern in the Mater and finally being a paid up doctor who was there to do a job felt like really a good move. And I had a great experience on my internship in the Mater. And I think particularly now when things are so different for junior doctors, you know, I was part of a team. I had other intern working with me, an SHO registrar and a couple of consultants. And we worked together during the day and then often we were on call together. So it was a really supportive, busy time, but hugely satisfying and enjoyable.
So we got to the end of your intern year. Did you start putting together jobs yourself then for the next couple of years?
I did. A friend of my sister's had worked in the American Hospital in Paris, and that sounded intriguing. So I was very lucky that all I had to do was write a letter and ask if I could come and work there. And that was my first job after being an intern in the Mater. So that was 6 months in Paris in a private hospital where I was working as an intern, really. The consultants were making all the decisions. Most of the junior doctors came from Ireland, the UK, New Zealand or Australia. And there were a whole stream of students coming through as well. And it was just one of the best 6 months ever. It felt like a real treat to be in a fabulous city where the job was set up that I had lots of time off. I had money to travel. And the only reason I stopped it, because actually you could keep going like that forever, was I wasn't learning anything. I was there to kind of clerk in patients and to be there on call, but to phone the consultant to make any decisions about anything. So I felt if I didn't leave after the 6 months, I would just lose whatever I'd learned in the Mater. So yeah, good first job though after an intern year.
How did your French do?
My French was okay at the time, mostly medical French, but I was hanging around with English-speaking people. So I guess that kind of got in the way of really becoming fluent in it. But it just means I've always got that very special connection with Paris and enjoy visiting. And I'm thinking I might try and brush up on it now that I'm working less.
Very good. And do you have to put together your own training scheme, basically, did you?
Yeah, so I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I had really enjoyed diabetes and endocrinology in the Mater, and I was wondering about that. And then I thought, well, I'll just keep going with some broad kind of general medical jobs. And a few of the people I was working with in Paris were from Scotland and insisted that that's where I had to go if I was going to go anywhere. And I thought that sounded like a fine plan. So I ended up working in A&E, which was, again, I think one of the great jobs to do. You feel like if you've worked in A&E for 6 months, then you can deal with what's turning, you know, what's going to happen. You know, that idea of you have to be ready for whatever comes in the door. And I think we were fairly light in medical staff. So, you know, we really had to take things on and manage things. And then I was kind of more thinking about being a GP. The next job was with old age geriatric medicine in Glasgow. And that was my first experience of working in a multidisciplinary team, which I hadn't really encountered so much before. And I really enjoyed that whole kind of broad assessment of the patient's functioning and thinking about rehabilitation and what they needed. And then I had thought that I was going to go back to Ireland, but I had 5 months because the jobs in the UK and Ireland were a bit out of sync. So to start back in Ireland in July, I thought, well, I would go and see a bit more of the UK. So I spent some time doing locums in a whole variety of specialties around South Wales and Southwest England, and then ended up in Poole and Dorset, doing a whole variety of things before I went back to Ireland to do obstetrics and paediatrics.
Right, and at that point you gained a lot of extra knowledge, but probably hadn't done any psychiatry yet.
That's right, exactly. And as I say, you know, that probably would have been part of my training if I was going to keep going with GP training. But it was the paediatrics and the DCH that just really pointed me in the direction that I think was a good fit with my interests and skills.
And then how long before you went back to the UK?
The paediatrics and obstetric jobs were linked, and I applied for psychiatry, and I started in St. Pat's in the year following that. But while I was doing obstetrics, I went on a skiing holiday to Austria and met a very lovely Scotsman and ended up pursuing the rest of my psychiatry training and career in Glasgow.
Very good. Well, that answers that question. I didn't know the story there, so that's new information for me.
Well, I guess there were a couple of things that came together there, where I had lived in Glasgow, so I knew the city, but also I knew it had a very good reputation as a training scheme placement for psychiatry, which was very much the case. So very strong training there, really good trainers, and so it felt like my husband is a lawyer, and retraining to work in Ireland would have been a lot more complicated.
And you've been in the NHS in Scotland mostly, I suppose. What do you think of the trajectory of the NHS over the past few years? Is it going to turn around? It's had some struggles with the funding model, I think.
It has. It's got struggles with the funding model and with the change in demographics and population and expectations. Yeah, I think it's very hard to see it thriving or being anything close to what it was like when I came over first, in terms of meeting people, you know, where just it was service on demand, and it felt like a really solid service to move over and work within. Very comprehensive, very good community-based services. I think the emphasis has probably been stronger there than what I'd encountered in Ireland. Unfortunately, it feels like the money and the attention keeps on, for understandable reasons, getting pulled towards the emergencies and acute presentations. So we're into the funding model where it keeps on going into secondary healthcare, because that's where people are turning up. And that just feels like it's a never-ending money pit there. And it seems it's difficult to really get robust community-based services which can provide more preventative, early intervention treatment and multidisciplinary support for people, so they don't need to end up in hospital.
Is the child and adolescent mental health service suffering more than most? Or?
Well, I think what's happened in the UK has been seen pretty much across the world, which is demand for mental health services for the under 18s has soared. There's been a real increase in the prevalence of mental illness in children and young people, but also increased recognition. And we were making some progress because we've always lagged behind other specialties in terms of funding and focus. So we were doing better here. I was involved with the Scottish Government for a day a week when COVID struck, and we had been really working well on thinking about how do we invest in this service across health, education, social services, third sector. How do we do this properly to really meet the needs of children and young people? And then COVID, as you'll know, has had a really toxic impact on children and young people's mental health. But also the funding has just completely dried up, because COVID has been such a financial problem in terms of funding for all the systems and services.
And where do you think that the tail of COVID is now in terms of mental health? What's better? What's unresolved?
We are still seeing children and young people who were affected by the COVID lockdowns. And I think that tail is still there. You know, where in some aspects of our life, it's as if it never happened. And yet I think for the most vulnerable children, you will hear still now that they might be presenting for the first time. And particularly those, for example, with, you know, neurodevelopmental conditions or learning disability, that change in what was offered in terms of schooling, access to peers, to community services. People really, you know, some families really suffered during that time. Some children just have never gotten back to where they were, but also some services have never gotten back to where they were before COVID. So yeah, we're still feeling its impact.
I suppose the other thing that's been going on the past few years is the whole concept of neurodivergence or neurodiversity has also picked up, and I suppose a lot more people are being diagnosed with mental health issues, I guess, than were before.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there are lots of different reasons there. And it's always difficult with the media or politicians because they really want you to give them one answer to that, to about why that's happened. But I think we know it's a whole lot of different things. So certainly in the UK, the trend was upwards before COVID. Social inequality and poverty are really toxic for children's mental health. Then, as I say, the pandemic just exacerbated all of that. But in terms of neurodivergence, I think a lot of it was unrecognised. And it's really interesting meeting with families where their child is being presented for assessment of possible ADHD or autism. And the parents will talk about what their growing up was like. And I think a lot of it wasn't recognised. I think particularly boys and young men were written off as being a bit badly behaved or not interested. And in retrospect, I would think, you know, it sounds like they had ADHD. They may even still have some aspects of ADHD. And I think we probably in some ways were more accepting of people who were a bit different or eccentric. And now people might be more likely to get a diagnosis of autism. But for others, their needs weren't met at all.
And I noticed that, I mean, both you and earlier on your unit got awards in the NHS. But I think 2017 was the unit award. What did that unit have that was different or better than other units?
Well, this was the Royal College of Psychiatrists. They have an awards kind of ceremony every year. And that was for the team I was leading, the paediatric liaison psychiatry team in the Children's Hospital in Glasgow. And what we had done was manage a move from one hospital to the other, where the age range had gone up from up to 14 years to up to 16 years. And the number of referrals had really changed with that because we were bringing in a lot more teenagers who were acutely unwell. And we had to reconfigure our services and really collaborate with a lot of people across the hospital and with other community-based services to meet their needs. And also where we've been developing as a specialty. So when I started off as a consultant, if a child wasn't eating enough and had a diagnosis of eating disorders and they came to a children's hospital for admission, they would be pretty well, you know, given a bit of refeeding and then sent on to a psychiatric inpatient care unit. And instead, we had a 2-week, very intensive programme of supporting the child and family to help them to eat enough, to get the psychological support, but to really manage meal times and prevent other behaviours which would stop them losing weight. And then that would set them usually to go home with intensive community-based support rather than needing psychiatric admission. Because we know that those admissions can be very prolonged, can cause more trouble and more difficulties for the young person. So, you know, the prognosis is a lot better if you can get them home. So I think it was for a combination of reasons that we were awarded the China Adolescent Mental Health Team of the Year.
And I have to congratulate you. You subsequently were awarded the President's Award from the Royal College of Psychiatrists, President's Medal, I believe, in just last year.
It was just November. Yeah, thank you. That was, I think, on the back of I've done quite a lot of work with the Royal College of Psychiatrists, first in Scotland, where we have our own kind of devolved China and Adolescent Faculty, and then as chair of the UK Child and Adolescent Faculty for the last 4 years. It's been a fairly torrid time to be leading and representing child psychiatrists, given all the demands and the difficulties with services. But it was great to receive the medal because it was very much on behalf of my colleagues. And within the RC Psych, it's an all-age college. It seems that we still have to keep reminding people about the needs of the under 18s. Often adults tend to soak up the focus and at the service level, the funding. So it was a good recognition that if we start intervening earlier in life, we can actually make much more substantial difference to people than if we wait until problems are entrenched well into adulthood.
Very good. And again, a great achievement. How's your job structure now?
My job structure now is very different. We moved city, so we're now living in Edinburgh. And I had been working with the Learning Disability CAMS team in Glasgow, but another colleague was ready to apply. So I've now stopped working with the NHS in Glasgow. I'm working in a neurodevelopmental service in Edinburgh a couple of days a week at the moment. And I'm still doing work with the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And I'm going to unashamedly plug our podcast as well, if you don't mind, Pat. It's accessible on the RC Psych website. It's called Children's Mental Health, Listen Up. And it covers different clinical conditions for the general public as well as for specialists. And then also we are still working on a report describing what good looks like and what child and adolescent psychiatrists should do. So, it feels like I'm in a bit of a transition period at the moment. And I'm just keeping my eyes open in case there's something really fascinating that might come up that I'll be interested in. But I'll see how I get on.
Well, the podcast is a good start. Who knows where that'll lead?
Indeed.
I mean, this is a good time to ask about work-life balance, I think. How have you maintained it and what advice do you have?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that I would have talked about to trainees over the years and to colleagues as well, you know, when you're in a kind of leadership or management role. Medicine is such a privilege in terms of the opportunity we get to find out all about our patients, to try and improve their lives and to be able to affect treatments that are going to make a difference. But it could also suck everything from you. One of the things about working in the UK that I was aware of was that as soon as I was starting to have a family, I was able to work less than full time, which felt like a really helpful balance. And I think that's something that's been more recognised generally, but I think it can be sometimes difficult to get that. So being able to work 3 or 4 days a week has always been helpful. I can't emphasise enough the benefit of physical exercise. And I think particularly for psychiatry or particularly for any doctors where their jobs involve them generally being seated and absorbing and containing and managing other people's emotions and very difficult scenarios, that there is a real need to get out there and burn off some physical energy at the end of the day and the weekends, as well as keeping up with family and friends and other interests.
So you go hiking?
I quite like going hiking, but I think what got me through my most challenging consultant years is probably running. And I wasn't any great athlete, but I would just do the kind of the 10K, the women's 10K in Glasgow was a great event. And then cycling or just generally being out and about. I think being outside and being active is one of the great pleasures in life. And our move to Edinburgh has us now living by the seaside. So that's feeling like a real quality of life.
And your kids, where are they and what are they up to?
Well, as I remind our kids, we have two sons, that one of the greatest gifts they ever received was having an Irish mother, which means that they have a European passport, as well as all the other great things that come with having an Irish mother. So our older son studied law in Scotland. He's working in Brussels, one of the European banking associations, and having a great time, by all accounts. I think there's a lot of people in their 20s and 30s who go to Brussels from all over Europe and internationally. So I think it's a good place to network, and he's enjoying that. And our other son is a journalist in London, having studied politics and international relations. So I think also being Irish, we've always talked about politics and current affairs, and things have been fairly lively from that point of view for the last maybe 10 years here in Scotland. So I think that's certainly given them an interest in that area.
Yeah, that might be a bit too lively in discussion sometimes, yeah. I'd imagine.
Yes, indeed.
What about more sedentary hobbies? Anything in terms of reading, music, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm in two book groups because reading has always been a complete pleasure. And as I said to you, I think my school kind of set me up kind of appreciating music, and I've been in choirs and involved in that side of things. But one of the appeals of Edinburgh also is there's just so much going on. So in terms of being able to go out and about to theatres and concerts and galleries and all of that, it's a great spot to be. It's very lively.
Well, that was a good plan, and it seems to be working. What about holidays? What do you do for holidays?
Well, for the sake of our marriage, we keep skiing. We just think that we're very lucky to be able to do it. And then Ireland and Scotland, you know, we have to go to the west of Ireland every summer. And that's a very important part of our year. And we connect with family and friends there. And both of our lads are very connected with their Irish heritage and with their cousins and friends. So that's really important to all of us. And then a bit of sunshine. So usually come autumn, we'll maybe head somewhere south to Italy or somewhere like that.
And will your boys be up for Scotland or Ireland when they play rugby?
Well, I think it's to their advantage that they have two teams to support. I think we will all cheer on Scotland because they need support. And it's been a tough ask being a Scottish rugby supporter in the last 10, 20 years. So it's been great to have Ireland to cheer for as well.
Very, very diplomatic answer. What about a bucket list? Where do you want to go that you've never been?
Well, I'm sure you've heard of several people recently talking about Japan. It seems to be really popular. And we've got my sister is going and some friends are going there soon. I'll be intrigued to hear about that. I've liked reading Japanese novels. I think their culture sounds fascinating. I think Japan is definitely on the list. In some ways, we're lucky that both of our lads have stayed close to home within Europe. And I think other friends have gone to Australia and New Zealand because their grown-up children have headed there. I think if we had a reason to go to that part of the world, I'd be interested. Otherwise, always tempted by maybe the fjords in Norway at some stage. The South America also looks intriguing, but given global politics at the moment, we might stay close to home.
Do you think in terms of a legacy?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, you know, where that phrase about all political career ends in failure. I think if you get involved in the leadership role, you have to be prepared to walk away where things feel unfinished. And I hope that I have done something useful while I've been in those roles. But it's so much ongoing progress, you know, with other people taking up the mantle. But if I had anything that I would really love to see would be that the needs and the opportunities of children, young people getting the services they deserve is more recognised. That would be what I'd really hope.
We're coming to a close now, and I wanted to just give you the opportunity, knowing that you put together a lot of your career yourself, would you advise yourself to do it differently if you could go back?
I feel really lucky with what I was able to do. I think to have that option to travel and to literally follow my nose a little bit, you know, when I was doing some of the locum jobs, knowing that the work was there, I was going to get paid well. Back in the day, there were doctor's residences where I could sleep. You know, there was very little to have to worry about. So I really enjoyed all of that. I think it's more when you commit to a consultant post and family, then the options for maybe traveling or doing something different reduce. And I think maybe looking back, it might have been good to think about a sabbatical or to think about getting a chance to work abroad at that level would have been really interesting.
Well, it's been great getting the chance to catch up. I want to congratulate you again on your achievements and thank you for your time. And I look forward to seeing this up online. And maybe you can mention our podcast when you're on yours next.
Absolutely. I'd be delighted. And it's been lovely catching up with you. And thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you. Thanks, Elaine.